We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart Podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.
Thank you for coming back to the Quick Restart Podcast. I'm Terry Foy, joined as always by Quint Kesnick, and we were originally planning for this to be something of a season recap slash summer preview podcast, but Quint, all those plans got put on hold. Sunday night, I reported that Gary Gate will take over for John Desko as the fifth men's lacrosse coach in Syracuse history. He had been the women's coach since 2008, and candidly, lacrosse stories don't get much bigger than this.
I agree. Are you 100% sure with your story?
Yes.
Great. Okay. Yeah, it's a big. This is a big splash. I mean, this is like this is major news when you think about sports. You know, guys like Urban Meyer being hired at Ohio State. Steve Spurrier back when he took the Florida job. You know, lacrosse significance. I don't know. You know, Bill Tierney moving from Princeton to Denver. Maybe when Dom was hired at Virginia was big. Petro back to Hopkins. You know, you think about the history of lacrosse, and this is significant in a lot of different ways. So we'll see. There's still a lot of news to develop in terms of who's his staff, what's the trickle down with some recruits. And I think on the way out, we've got to give John Desko an enormous amount of credit for really taking the Roy Simmons Jr., you know, eras, decades of success, and running with that and being involved in so many of these championships back since 1983 as an assistant coach, then 89 as an assistant, and then multiple titles. So, you know, John Desko, Hall of Fame coach, tough ending, but an incredible career who, you know, only one of Laurie Cox, Simmons Sr., Simmons Jr., Desko, and now Gate.
Let's start with a little bit more on Desko. He won 5 national championships as the head coach of Syracuse men's lacrosse. He's a 1979 Syracuse lacrosse alum, and he had been an assistant from 1980 until when he took over, I believe, in 1997. He amassed a career record of 265-92. I mean, you know, being that close to a winning 2/3 of your game percentage is a pretty incredible breakdown. And even in this, his final season, as it's expected that he'll announce his retirement later this week, he still beat the national champion twice. And I think there's a combination of a conversation that needs to be had, not just around Desko's legacy, but also around fair expectations for this program. So what is your thought? And I think that this will probably translate a little bit into talking about expectations for Gary as well. But what is your thought about the current place in the lacrosse ecosystem that Syracuse sits or occupies, given they haven't been to championship weekend since losing to Duke in the title game in 2013?
It's a great question, and I kind of wrote down a list, and correct me here, Terry, work me through this list. Where does lacrosse matter most, okay? Where does winning a national championship, where does making it to championship weekend actually factor into a coach's and the program's place on campus, okay? I would say that at Syracuse, old Johns Hopkins, I'm not sure if that's still the standard at Hopkins, I would say Maryland and Virginia, like lacrosse matters at those places. My second tier of teams would be places like Loyola, Notre Dame, Duke, and Carolina. And then my third tier would be Ivies and the other Big Tens, the other Power Fives. Is that accurate? Do you agree with that?
I think Syracuse and Hopkins exist on a tier on their own above Maryland and Virginia. And the reason I feel that way is kind of different for each place. I feel that way about Syracuse because despite the fact that attendance isn't at the level that it was at the height of Syracuse lacrosse popularity in the Carrier Dome, it's still by far the best in college lacrosse. And the way in which that team matters in the local community, I mean, the slogan is New York State's team, New York City's team. It's like the professional. Syracuse football, basketball, and lacrosse are like the pro sports in central New York. And they get covered that way. So it's not just about fan attendance, it's also about media attention. And you look at the other news outlets, the radio stations, the daily newspapers, and the television stations that have picked up this news in the last 13, 14 hours. We record this at about 8 o'clock on Monday morning. It's unlike anything you would have seen with any other job in lacrosse at all. So to me, that is still an indication of the degree to which sports lacrosse matters. Maybe not necessarily on campus, although I do believe that it does, but more so within the community at large. And for Hopkins, I think it comes down to history. And so to the extent that I think your comment is more about the current administration's attitude toward the sport, looking at it from like a president on down perspective. And to me, I agree. But Johns Hopkins has changed as an institution more in the last 20 to 30 years than pretty much any institution that plays lacrosse. And so there's just a lot of competing variables that didn't come into play when you were a student there, and certainly before that, when lacrosse and the connection between the history of the game and the history of the institution was something that everybody on campus cared about. All that being said, while that can diminish, however slightly, it doesn't go away. And so I still do think that lacrosse matters more at Syracuse and Johns Hopkins than it does elsewhere. That being said, when you talk about the tier of Maryland and Virginia, I understand why you feel that way, and it probably is more about resource allocation than anything else. But I would say that when you look at it as a percentage of resources, you gotta consider including Denver, Loyola, and potentially even Albany. Probably not from a resource allocation standpoint, but when you combine the fanship of the Capital Region into it in a way that's similar to Syracuse, I would say that those would be three that I would include, maybe not firmly in that second tier, but certainly worthy of conversation ahead of places like Duke and Carolina.
Yeah, I would agree with that, except remember, Denver hockey will always be number one. The Albany area hasn't come out in general, other than a few games here and there in terms of fan attendance. And Loyola, certainly the lacrosse program, I think is number one, if not a shared number one with basketball on that campus.
It is now officially Maverick May Madness on InsideLacrosse.com. And the new Maverick EKG shoulder pads and chest protector are here for all players. Get upgraded performance protection that meets the new Noxie safety standards. Shop the whole line on lax.com/EKG. So with respect to Syracuse, obviously the landscape has changed. We just talked about a bunch of programs, two of which have won national championships and a third in Albany that has started to recruit from the traditional bases that have populated the orange roster for two decades, such that the level of competition has just increased. The number of programs that are vying for a spot in championship weekend has increased so dramatically since Syracuse went to 22 straight Final Fours. What is a fair expectation for what this program should be doing on a five-year basis? Like every 5 years, they should be doing X.
They should be making every, you think every lacrosse recruit, your goal would be to win a national championship and to play in championship weekend at least once in your four years. I think that would be, that's the recruiting pitch that I'm going to sell. And if you don't play for a championship in your 4 years, I consider that a disappointment. If you don't make it to championship weekend, that's a severe disappointment. Because that's the pitch.
So on the basis of essentially having two recruiting cycles, right, 8 years of players that didn't make it to championship weekend, I'm going to guess that you're not in
a
position.
What was the JoJo Marasco? They played in the semifinals. And they played in the finals in what, 14 or 15?
In 13.
13, right. Okay, that's our last championship appearance. So you do have, you know.
Yeah, that was eight years ago. That was two full cycles. So that's what I'm saying. Like, do you agree with this? You know, to the extent that this was a decision as opposed to an outcome, do you think that this was an appropriate course of action?
I do, given the way this year transpired, given the Chase Scanlon situation, given the underperforming of this program, I do. You know, Syracuse got a lot on their agenda right now. On their John Wildhack has got a softball situation. He's got a women basketball situation. He's got a football team, and I love Dino Babers. They're struggling right now. They just put a lot of money into the dome. You know, he's the program is at the crossroads across the board. Syracuse athletics are. So I think him making this move when he did to lock up Gary was a shrewd move, and the timing's good. We'll see what Gary does with his staff, and we got to talk about Gary's impact because
Yeah, well,
I
let's get
have
there. Let's get there in a second because I got to put a little
yeah
bit of skin
so
in the
so
game.
so so, so I have no problems with the way this shook down.
So I, you know, this is not a cop out. You'll be able to read between the lines in terms of what I feel should have happened, but my focus has always been on what would happen, right? Over the course of the last certainly 4 weeks at this point since Syracuse lost to Georgetown. In one-sided fashion in the first round of the NCAA tournament. But even preceding that, when I was having a lot of conversations with college coaches and other sources about whether the Scanlon situation was going to adversely affect Desko's ability to return, I haven't reported this, but I have been told by sources that he had 1 year remaining on his deal. His contract ran through the 2022 season. And my interpretation of the course of events. And again, I wrote a piece at this point more than a month ago about how a new Title IX regulation changed the way in which discipline could be handled for students, including student athletes, accused of any type of violation that falls under Title IX. And what Chase was accused of falls under that purview. And what it essentially means, what this new adjudication is meant to do, is protect folks who are falsely accused from being suspended or expelled from school before having some sort of access to something that resembles due process. And my interpretation of the press conference in which Chase was reinstated was John Desko saying, Chase is being reinstated. After being suspended for a violation of team rules, in order to.
Comply with the Title IX, yes.
Exactly.
That's not my issue, Terry. My issue is what
That it.
happened prior to that. And I hate to make the example, George Hughley situation. There were red flags all along. That young man should have been either separated from the team, given treatment. His situation should have been approached. And the same in the Scanlon situation, if everything I hear is true. You know, there were red flags prior to the moment you're talking about that any team has to address.
Understood. All that being said, the and I'm admitting that I was wrong. My expectation was that John Desko was going to be the coach in 2022. And I felt that way for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is the recent track record of Syracuse athletics in terms of their coach retention and everything that kind of goes along those lines. And it leads me to believe that the ability to secure a candidate like Gary Gate was ultimately the deciding factor in the extent to which this was a decision, meaning that it wasn't John's decision to retire, which I'm not saying it was or wasn't. I don't know that, but to the extent that it was or wasn't, the ability to replace him with a candidate like Gary, who is widely considered to be the best lacrosse player of all time, has just tremendous coaching experience. Certainly has won national championships as an assistant for Cindy Timchell at Maryland and has been a head coach of a Division I program for 15 years and has also coached a lot of men's lacrosse. And I talked to a couple of players who have played for him in various stops, be it in the NLL or when he was kind of in more of like a player coach capacity, a couple instances in the MLL. And so, you know, I want to talk about, does the fact that he has never been a D1 men's lacrosse coach matter? But before we get to that, let's just talk about Gary because I feel like it's almost impossible to answer the second question without giving an audience who may or may not be totally familiar with who he is a better sense for who he is. And, you know, Gary is somebody that you have competed against. How many times do you think you've been on the same field as him? 200?
Well, no, it's a lot deeper than that, Terry. You know, a lot of people don't know. We competed against each other. We then after college, I covered him while the MILL indoor league was on ESPN2 with Leif Elsmo and Christy Lee. We then became teammates in, I don't know, 94, 95, 96, first with Mount Washington Lacrosse Club and then into the Toyota Lacrosse Club era, which lasted, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. Then we became teammates for the Baltimore Thunder in 98, 99. And that may have been my best glimpse into Gary as an emerging coach. At the time, I think he was at Maryland working for Cindy Timchell. And, you know, to be a floor runner, a defender, and covering him in practice, just I mean, he's basically like having a coach on the field. Just amazed at his temperament, his ability to, as the best player, he never gave off the attitude of the best player. He's one of the hardest workers on the team, but he's always willing to share, to ask questions, to and never overextend any kind of boundaries. So he's always very comfortable. He's an amazing teammate. And I was always super impressed prior to that when I covered him, you know, being down on those benches and watching the beating that he would routinely take. I mean, there is no player in the history of the game who was slashed, had his head trying to be taken off, double teamed, everything to try to get in that guy's head. And I never saw him lose it. He was so mentally tough. He would come off. He was constantly injured, his elbows, his hands, you know, his legs started going out on him, you know, as he got older. And man, he just continued to deliver while everybody was out to get him. And I thought there was a transformation there, too, you know, in the mid 90s when he started coaching the women's game and what he brought to those young women there, you know, the elements of the men's game, the elements of his indoor game, the elements of creativity and having fun, the elements of keeping it simple, you know, but then adding wrinkles. And so it's been wonderful to, you know, have a friendship with him. He's the most easygoing guy. Like lacrosse is the community where can be fractured in some cases where people at some levels don't get along because they're rivals. Gary is, everyone loves Gary. I mean, I don't know a single teammate or opponent or, you know, person, fan that he's ever shook the wrong way on and off the floor or field. It's truly amazing.
So I don't know him nearly that well. I've interacted with him a dozen times probably. And so my comments come more from like the observer's point of view. And I think the thing you said toward the end of your comments that resonates the most with me is just laid back. He is, for someone who has accomplished so much, it is remarkable that he's capable of being so not intense in like social and normal kind of non-game winning environments. And I think that that comes from three places. So the first is just natural, right? And I think, you know, because he shares a lot of that with his brother, I would imagine it has a lot to do with their family and their home. And I've known a handful of folks from Victoria, British Columbia, and I think that that culture is it. I don't want to say it like breeds a laid back style, but it's definitely like, you know, kind of coastal small town environment. And I think that that has a lot to do with it. The second is a comfort with what you have accomplished, right? Once you become referred to as the greatest of anything, I have to believe that that goes one of two ways. It either feeds like a maniacal approach to trying to maintain that, or it gives you a sense of confidence on which you rely. And it kind of informs the rest of your perspective and almost like your existence. And then the third thing is the physical presence. I mean, the guy is enormous, and that's a huge, it's a huge reason he was successful as a player, but it's also translates into just a presence that you can carry. So, you know, he kind of has a walk tall, speaks awfully and carry a big stick type vibe that I was really kind of informed by. Our women's editor, Hallie Griggs, was on the NCAA semifinal broadcast working in the studio at ESPN with Cris Cotter, and Cotter asked her, because she was a part of the Lisa Miller to Gary Gate transition as a sophomore, was Gary's first season, what was it like when he arrived? And she said, we were Syracuse lacrosse players. Gary Gate was already the greatest player of all time, and obviously he was coming from this place where he had had so much success as well. And we were intimidated, and then he walked in, and immediately it was Coach Gate, and then immediately made a joke at his own expense, and then he was Gary from that point forward. And the reverence with which that alumni group holds him, and the understanding of his approach to being the, what's the right word for it? Because figurehead implies that he doesn't do anything, and that's not what I'm trying to imply. But he, you know how some coaches are coaches of coaches, and they coach both ends of the field, and they coach every person on the roster, and they don't get bogged down in tactics? Like, more like a CEO than a coordinator that gets promoted to head coach. That is the reputation that Gary has as the Syracuse women's coach. Somebody who is very reliant on his assistance. And I think, as this conversation progresses, we'll transition into some of the speculation around that. But yeah, I think that it's just it's amazing. It's not surprising, but it is amazing that this news breaks. And with the exception of disappointment toward how the end of John Desko's tenure occurred at Syracuse, the reaction to the news is almost universally like jaw on the floor surprise. Not because people are like, it's not surprising in the way that it came out of left field. It's surprising in the way that it was always so logical, yet everyone never thought it would happen. And then combined with the notion that it was universally well responded to, and the guy's never been a Division I men's head coach. You know what I mean? So
Yeah.
that just
No.
it strikes a very strong chord for me.
Well, I think what Gary's done well strategically for his career is staying involved with the Team Canada on the boys and the men's side. And to be at those world games when he walks in the cafeteria and again, he fits in. He could go sit with the Iroquois team, he can sit with the Team USA, he can sit with Canada. Like it's truly amazing how he just fits in. He's not going to overimpose his greatest player. Again, the only time I think I saw him stress out as a lacrosse player was more on the sponsorship side, more on his the business side of it, the sticks with his brother, the cars from Toyota, all the extras that he didn't want, but he always kind of, I think, pushed for behind the scenes. To make a career in the sport of lacrosse, not as aggressively, obviously, as the guys today. And social media wasn't up and running either. So he didn't have that to weigh that kind of responsibility. Because quite frankly, at the time, I don't think he'd been very good at it. None of us would have, but especially it's just not in his personality. He's completely not the type of guy who's going to post selfies. I tell you that much. But again, the staying relevant in the international sphere with Team Canada on the men's side, I think is important because it does check that box. And so I think any questions, if you're the AD, are answered through that sphere.
So let's just answer the question I asked 10 or 15 minutes ago. Do you think being a Division I men's lacrosse coach is such a unique position relative to other types of lacrosse coach that, despite having been successful in other realms of coaching, it's not a foregone conclusion that he'll be successful in this? Or do you think that coaching is coaching, and he'll figure it out?
He'll figure this out quickly. No, I would say, look, the guy's been on in the spotlight since 1987 when he scored his first goal against my roommate Dave Howland on a left-handed cut in the opener of that 87 season in the Dome. Dave broke his wooden shaft on Gary's arm. He came off the field. I was on the bench that game. It wasn't even a starter yet. And I was like, "What happened, man?" And Dave was a big, strong guy. He goes, I slashed him as hard as I could, and the stick just broke on his arms. That was Gary's first goal. And then I remember in the semifinals that year watching him score 5 against Cornell. And basically in my head, like rooting for Cornell, because Gary came on at the end of that his freshman year where he's averaging nearly like 5 goals a game over the last 3 or 4. And we're like, what the heck is this? You know, this lefty Canadian, this giant lefty Canadian who could run like the wind. And they lost in that semifinal. Making this switch, look, if you analyze the good teams in lacrosse right now, what does it come down to? It comes down to recruiting. You got to have the players. You got to get the best players. You know, I think that Virginia, Maryland, Duke, teams who have won recent championships, okay, it's talent based, and then you put them in appropriate schemes. Do teams win and lose big games on championship weekend because of schemes? Well, not really. It's the execution of what they do, whether it's a 10-man ride, whether it's a motion offense, whether it's a pick-and-roll game. Defensively, Maryland lost the national championship because they made some pretty clear defensive mistakes, basic things. This is not rocket science. Again, recruit great players, give them simple schemes, play to their strengths, develop a strong team culture, play as a team. I thought Denise and Kark made a great point on our yard sale show about the best roster doesn't win. It's the best 10 guys out in the field at a time who are playing like a team. I think that explained why Duke never got over the top this year and why a team like Loyola had some late season success. And Gary understands that, you know, even when he was the dominant player, I think he always understood, like, you know, he kind of looked at me before the game, like, you got to make some saves today if we're going to win this game. I was like, oh, yeah, I know. You know, I kind of laugh at him. I'm like, if you score 5, that'll help our case too, Gary. I think he's the answer to my question is I see no issues with him segueing. The only things I see, I mean, honestly, we could talk about, you know, relationships. Okay. But Gary is such a nice person and a good guy. And a likable, and again, he gets along with everybody. That forming a new relationship with a high school coach or a club coach who he's never met is not going to be an issue. That would be something, you know, he doesn't know who coaches Madlax, or he doesn't have a relationship with Team Carolina club coach, or doesn't have a relationship with the head coach of Boys Latin, Brian Farrell. You know what I mean? But I don't see those, because when the phone rings and you look at it and it's Gary Gate, he's going to have your respect. You've only heard good things about him as a man. And so I think you move on and it's going to work.
So you've mentioned that who he fills out his staff with as being a really important part of this story. It's been reported that Pat Marsh will remain as the offensive coordinator. I have been told that. I don't know it definitively. In addition to that, it has been reported that Dave Petromala is a leading candidate for defensive coordinator. And similarly, I have been told that, but do not know it definitively. It's my expectation that both those things will come to fruition.
Yeah. There's a lot of parts this week. And so we may have to do a podcast again on Tuesday or Wednesday. Again, the women's job becomes available. Who gets that? Is it Kayla Traynor? Is it Spallina from Stony Brook?
Let me jump in there. It was reported that Traynor was offered the job and turned it down. I can say almost 100% definitively that that is not true. She has not been offered the job. They will conduct a search for that position.
Okay. So that could impact Joey Spallina's recruiting, maybe. I don't know. The other thing is, if Petromala ends up going to Syracuse, do his sons follow him there? There's going to be a ripple effect here in terms of other coaching spots and then recruiting that goes forward. And I think it's a good, if Dave does take the job, I would encourage, like, if Dave called me today, like, what do you think? I'd be like, I think you should take it, because the longer you stay out of the game, I think the less employable you are for the next Power 5 lacrosse job that comes up. And so this is a win-win situation. I mean, this would be the absolute dream team of all time. Can you imagine 22 and 43, you know, calling you as a high school recruit, whether regardless of position, you'd be dealing with the best in the history of the modern game. So I think that's a huge plus. You know, if you're Cuse, there's 3 things I got on my list, Terry, honestly, 3 things I have to address. And I want to get your opinion on this. 60-man roster, practicing in Manly with one field. Okay, if you do the math nowadays, if you have a 60-man roster, you can't effectively practice on one field. Because if you do, and you're going 2 6-on-6s, that's what, 26 guys. That's less than half the team is engaged. If you're having a 60-man roster, you need an extra goal. You need a third goal with a 6-on-6, if not a fourth. And you need multiple goals and multiple space for drills. So I think these 60-man rosters who are being coached like 35-man rosters are struggling. That's one of the reasons why I think Virginia had some success late in the season. Their roster is not quite as bloated as others. So that's one thing. Second would be New York State high school lacrosse in upstate. I don't think it, because of the club, the way the club system has gone now, I'm not sure New York State public school lacrosse in central New York, western New York, Westchester, and Nassau County has kept pace with the rest of the country. Whereas when Syracuse was winning national championships in the 90s and 2000s, they're pulling highly from those areas. And then last, you know, the move to the ACC. How do you manage that with your out-of-conference schedule? Do you, you know, because you're always going to play Cornell and Hopkins. Like, what should the schedule look like given the strain of the ACC? Because since the ACC has come, since Syracuse has joined the ACC, you could say they haven't had the same kind of success.
That's an interesting point, because John Desko has the second best ACC winning percentage since joining the ACC. Like, and I share that not to refute your comment, because I agree with it. I share it because it's
Virginia was down, Carolina was down, they rallied. You know, Duke has been Duke; they've been consistent throughout.
Correct. So,
but again, you know,
and Syracuse has, like, by and large had Notre Dame's number.
Hopkins moving to the Big Ten, yeah, you get the AQ. Well, the ACC doesn't have an AQ. Hopkins gets the AQ, but I think it's really hurt the program moving to the Big Ten. Quite honestly, you're competing against schools who get $50 million plus a year from athletics, and you get nothing. Like, this is not a fair fight, and they're not academic peers as well. So, but Syracuse fits in the ACC clearly. But again, you point to wins and losses. I point to championship weekend and championships. It hasn't looked the same at the end of the year.
Sure. So, I with respect to the schedule, I actually, you know, I mean, do you think that they need to make significant changes? Because I don't. I think that
No, I don't. I just don't know. That's something that Gary will have to evaluate.
Like, sure.
In my eyes, they have to play Cornell, they have to play Hobart, and they have to play Albany out of league.
I agree, and I think they have to play at Albany. That would be one thing that I would really strongly advocate for. Obviously, it was supposed to happen this year, and it got rescheduled or maybe it was supposed to happen in 2020, and it got rescheduled. I think generally they need to play Army. At least one additional road game a year.
Yeah, I believe they have to play Army, and then do you add a Binghamton Canisius type, or do you play Rutgers? You know, who they typically had played years and years ago. Do you have a Georgetown from your old Big East affiliations, or do you go smaller tier schools that you need to play? There's some questions there, and it'll be interesting to see what Gary does. I would sense that Gary would ramp up. He's not the type of coach, I think. I think as a player, he always enjoyed the big games a lot more than he enjoyed the rinky-dink games.
Yeah.
And so I would say that he would ramp things up.
With respect to the bloated roster, he had the biggest roster in women's lacrosse. I don't recall whether they actually did it, but I think that they did. I'm pretty sure they played two games in one day on January 30th. 4 or 5 years ago, at the very least, it was planned.
And I saw waves and waves of players watching them on TV late this season, even for the NCAA games. It looks like that in my eyes, it's just look. I get why people are doing it. It's just got to be managed. It's got to be. I just worry about the dilution of reps and coaching. It's not like college football where you have 11 assistants out there,
right?
And so, I look at this year with freshmen on a 60-man roster standing around practice watching, not getting enough touches, not playing in any JV games, you know, any freshman games. So I just think it's a trend that teams have to manage better. Because, again, if you're coaching in the 35-player roster mentality where let's go two half fields. Well, it all looks and sounds good, but there's 26 guys engaged and 34 who are spectators. Okay. Let alone when, you know, when you go full field and it's 10 on 10. Hey, let's do some full field routing and clearing. You got 40 guys on the bench. You got 20 on the field. Okay. Like, and then when you, hey, let's do some shooting and you have one goal and 15 attackmen or 12 attackmen and 12 middies shooting on one goal. Does that really make sense? So that's a, everybody's got this issue and everyone's got to figure this thing out.
You asked a third question and I've forgotten what it was. It was rosters, schedule.
Well, New York State Public School lacrosse.
Yeah.
New York State Public, yeah. What do you think about that? I mean, West Jenny, Fayetteville, Homer, Yorktown, Long Island schools. Pat McCabe was from Elmont. You know, Syracuse always did well from Nassau County. Cuse always did well from those surrounding public schools in New York. That's how they built the program. I mean, West Genesee success parallels Syracuse success.
Yeah.
The game seems to have been skewing away from those dominant high school programs in New York and heading more towards club dominance.
So let's set aside the club conversation for just a second. I'll come back to it. But there are a couple of elements to it. So the first is, I think each pocket of or each region of New York State that you address needs to be kind of sectioned off separately. So with respect to the kind of dominant program, the dominant big school program, I mean, yeah, it is true that I think that there's been a little bit more democratization of public school lacrosse in the Syracuse area. And I think that that was part and parcel of Mike Massera's retirement. I think Victor's emergence, and it'll be interesting to see whether or not that persists with a new coaching staff, is somewhat of a replacement for it. And the difference being that, you know, Victor is, what, 90 minutes, 2 hours away from Syracuse, whereas West Genesee is 10 minutes, 15 minutes. So there needs to be an established pipeline that makes certain that the next TD Erlin does not go to Syracuse. I would say that, you know, should be a primary focus. I don't think that there has been a decrease in the number of players from New York State that have gone on to be All-Americans at the next level, both from Long Island.
Oh, Jared Connors. Jared Connors is an example of a guy from what, Rochester area?
Ben Reeves.
You know, he could be in a Syracuse. Ben Reeves is a guy who could have been a Syracuse. TD Erlin.
Connor Kelly.
Connor
Adam
Fields.
DeMille.
Yeah, so you're just saying they missed?
I'm saying that those programs that were producing them were not the traditional powerhouses, and as a result, the recruiting was less able to rely on high school coach referral, and it needed to rely more on the traditional talent evaluation process.
Okay. And the last positive I will bring up, Terry, for Gary is Native American and Canadian influx. And I think he'll do extremely well in both those departments. Look, this is a guy who would play tons of club box lacrosse during the summer. You know, whether it was in Western Canada or up in Eastern, you know, up in Toronto, he was constantly shuttling back and forth, playing multiple games a day, playing in multiple leagues, whether it was indoor, outdoor, club, pro, MLL. And so he has got strong ties to the Native American community, highly respected and well-liked. And clearly, you know, his relationship with Brody Merrill and BC and you know, Eastern Canadian lacrosse, I would sense that Cuse would get the pick of the litter from the Canadian pipeline.
Right. Now, I don't think that there will be a struggle to find talent. I do believe that the point you made about the Petromalas and Spallinas as players is a pertinent one. And I think ultimately, kind of the takeaway from this conversation is there's a lot of reasons for Syracuse fans to be excited and optimistic about this development while also feeling disappointed and nostalgic for the John Desko era, both in terms of the nostalgia for how incredible it was and disappointed in the way that it ended, both in terms of the fact that they didn't have a better 2021 season, particularly with expectations coming off of a good start in 2020 before the year was shut down, as well as the fact that it's been so long since they've been to championship weekend. So I think all these things can be true at the same time.
Yes, and I would agree with that. And Gary will make sure that Coach Desko's, his legacy is constantly, it's part of who he is. And you know, Roy Simmons Jr. and John Desco are absolute foundational, more than that. I mean, they are the program, and Gary gets that. And so I think there'll be, you know, long-term respect. Maybe there's some short-term pain, but incredible amounts of long-term respect. And the last thing for the fans, you know, they got to start showing up for games. You know, CUSA's advantage is the dome. They can play warm weather lacrosse in February and March. They can pack that place and make money for the program, and it can be a special place. I think they'll play an exciting brand of ball for Gary. I think he'll recruit great players and allow them a certain amount of freedom within some structure. And I think it'll be entertaining, and I hope to see more fans in the seats next time I'm in the dome.
All right, Quint, we have gone very long on one of the biggest stories that we will cover this year, but there were a couple other things that I want to touch on. First and foremost, Jared Bernhardt, Charlotte North, 2021 Towarden winners. Congratulations.
Yeah, no surprises here. You know, I just, Jimmy Bernhardt, Jared's dad, as I've said, was my high school football defensive coordinator. I've had a relationship with him until he passed away in 2019. I haven't had the guts to, you know, delete his number from my cell phone. This is a guy that, he shadowed my dad right when he got out of Hofstra as a football lacrosse player. He shadowed my dad for almost a month as a teacher and a coach. And, you know, when I talked to Jimmy in, I don't know, 2000 to 2019, I always felt like it was kind of like my dad's voice speaking through, you know, Mr. Bernhardt, Coach Bernhardt. And whether he was at, you know, Central Florida, Penn State, or then with the Houston Texans following his son's career, we would text, we would chat, we would, you know, I'd see him and I'd come down this. I watched a Hopkins Maryland game with him just a few years ago, sat with him and Catherine and the rest of their family. And, you know, I miss the guy, but I know he'd be super proud of his sons and Jared in particular with the way he played this year and the way he behaved.
Did you see the clip of Jake and Jesse watching the ceremony?
I did. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, these people they're solid as a rock people. I mean, they're really absolutely completely genuine. I mean, it's amazing.
My brothers are 10 and 8 years older than me. And I've said this before, but the reason I got into lacrosse is because my brother, who's 8 years older than me, started playing as a freshman in high school. And I was the water boy and ball boy on his teams. And so I was in, like, you know, second through fifth grade, maybe second through fourth, first through fourth, something like that. And, like, some of the coolest memories of my childhood were getting to ride to his, you know, big games against Upper Arlington and state semifinals and all that sort of stuff with his teammates. And I remember that his senior year riding down in the back of our family van with, like, the star midfielders and the best defenseman who, you know, went on to be a Boston College defensive lineman and played in the NFL for a couple years. And when you're 10, it's amazing. And I know that that is the experience that Jared had when Jake and Jesse were playing at Maryland. So I know how high the standard was for him to be successful in a way that he felt like was going to impress his brothers. And so watching that video, I could so acutely feel the sense of accomplishment. Like, I wish that somebody videoed Jared watching that for the first time, because I would imagine he probably couldn't see him where they were standing and where he was standing when he received the award. So when he saw that video, it was probably like, I mean, that is just like that's a moment when you just gulp and you just go like, yeah, that's a big part of the reason that I did it. It's a big part of the reason I'm here, is because of those two guys and my desire to be better than them and make them proud of me. And just to have that moment captured is something that if I were in his position, I would cherish for the rest of my life.
Yeah, I know. I've spent more time with Jesse than Jake. Jake's pretty intense. They're all quiet, but you know, every step of the way with Jesse was, I would always be like, oh, how's Jared doing, man? He's killing it. Like, the older brothers, I think, realized how talented the younger brother was. And the younger brother came with a lot more pressure. That's for sure. He wasn't the trailblazers that the first two were, but at every step, you know, Jared, you know, has taken on the adversity of losing a parent. He's taken on the adversity of the pandemic. And what he did late in this season, I think was just, it was mind boggling. And, you know, I too have two older brothers, one 6 years older than me and one 8 years older than me. And my proudest moments, Terry, retiring my brother from the sport of croquet when I went when he was 16. And I beat him and he threw his mallet into the woods up at our cabin in Woodstock, New York. He was 16 and he hasn't played since. And that was a great day. And the other great day was when I was like 11 or 10 and I beat him in the Esopus Creek tubing race. I beat both of them. It was this little squirt and I guess I was lighter on my tube. And I paddled and I paddled and down the river and I beat him. And those were I have those trophies, basically. Those rank higher than anything.
And shout out to Charlotte North. One of the cooler elements of the presentation occurring at Gillette Stadium, you know, realizing that kind of the dynamics and vibe of giving a Women's Player of the Year award at a men's lacrosse game, not great, but really awesome that because it was in Boston, all of her teammates were able to be there. So as soon as she won, the roar, oh man, that was chills inducing.
Yeah, I was with five 10-year-olds at the Belmont actually on Saturday, who were at the PLL game on Friday, and they're young boys and they play up in the Boston area. They're Charlotte North fans. Okay, so like I've never seen a women's lacrosse player who can also have fans on the boys' side. So what she is doing not only is inspiring young women, but it's inspiring even young boy players, which you know I've never encountered anything like that.
I mean, it has been an incredible, I want to say calendar year, dating back to, say, the start of 2020 for women's sports in terms of shining spotlights on areas that need to be improved, as well as championing all the impressive and successful things that women athletes have done in the last year. And I think the combination of Abby Wambach shouting out Charlotte North when she was watching the replay of the championship, plus the news about Athletes Unlimited and the number of games that'll be televised in this restarted Women's Pro League or startup, I guess kind of depends on what term you want to use there, just incredible. And, you know, to this point, I don't think it's publicly known whether Charlotte intends to return for her additional year of eligibility with the Eagles. And obviously it's a great thing that the platform as a pro continues to develop, but I guess I'll just say I hope that she wants to run this one back, because it would be incredible to see her in Chestnut Hill one more time.
Yeah, I think social media plays a huge part in her success and her notoriety and the ability for thousands of people to watch a good 12-second clip as opposed to only 50,000, you know, watching the NCAA championship game on ESPNU, which is a number that's quite low. I mean, there was more people who watched the MIAA championships on YouTube. So again, that needs to be improved, whether it's programming, the marketing of the women's game, the promotion of the women's game. But for now, I think her clips, her viral clips of these plays she's able to make are inspirational for young players of both sexes.
Do you have any reaction to opening weekend at PLL?
I do. You know, I thought it was good. Looked like Paul found a shooting stroke. There's a couple rosters that I don't like. I look at them and I'm like, how's this team going to win? The roster formation is not. I don't know. I watch so much MLL that you know you win with midfielders and you win with defense. And it doesn't seem like these teams. I don't know. But I thought the action was good. I thought, you know, the condensed field I struggle with because I think it's actually decreased the amount of transition, and I love fast breaks. And then I think long term, it's, you know, I think the too many games over the course of a weekend, a hot weekend at one site, I'm not sure that's going to be the business model long term. Okay. Two or three games a weekend, maybe at a site, Friday night, Saturday afternoon, Saturday night, or what. But I think when you go further than that, you drain the lemon. I think you hit a point of no return. And so I think that's got to be evaluated. Again, long-term. Touring model, yes, I love it. We need to be around the country. Do we need to play four games or five games in every site? Do we go multiple sites a weekend and hit more sites? You know, I don't know what the finances look behind that, but I think long term, that's certainly on the table, and Paul will figure it out. But I thought it was a good start. I thought it was a good start for the league, and you know, I went 2 for 2 with my picks on Sunday.
We got to get Quint involved in the Inside Lacrosse weekly picks so that he can stop chirping me about the picks that I get wrong when he's not on the record having made a pick either direction.
I was on the record with these two picks this week.
Right. And
please tell
also,
the audience. Please tell the audience.
Did I go 5-0? I had a good week.
I liked Virginia in their last three playoff games because they were underdogs. And I was like, well, they can win all these games. I don't see why they're underdogs. Why were they underdogs to Georgetown? That was one of the most bizarre lines I've ever seen.
All right, Quint. We'll be back later in the week with a PLL podcast, and we'll figure out at some point when we're going to do a quick restart to recap the entirety of the 2021 season. But as you mentioned, more news likely on the horizon, and make sure to check out InsideLacrosse.com. Follow us on Twitter. I am at Terrence Foy. He is at Q Kesnick. We are at Inside_Lacrosse. We are at Inside_Lacrosse. _Lacrosse would be a funny name or a funny Twitter account to follow. And we are also on Instagram at Inside Lacrosse. Any parting shots, my man?
Yeah, I just want to thank the fans. I've bumped into we got 400,000 people watch the finals. It feels like 7.6 million watch the finals, because everywhere I go, whether it's the grocery store, I was at the Belmont in the paddock, and guy went to college with Garno's dad, came over and loved the game. The kids loved it. Like, strangers coming up to me like, hey, that was a great championship game. Like, it seems like a lot more than four watch the game. So thank you for watching. And then there's a couple along the way who actually listened to this podcast, and they love the World War II stories we told about Enners and McLaughlin and Turnbull. And you know, that feedback it's great energy. You know, it's why we do this. So we appreciate you listening. Have a great summer. And the Syracuse news will be popping over the next week. And then later in the month, we'll have a lot of cool high school action, whether it's Inside Lacrosse events. We got Naptown. We got World Series of Youth Lacrosse. There's a lot going on this summer now that the pandemic is lifted. We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart Podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.